study of this topic. I want to announce that tomorrow night, Lord willing to spare, we'll be talking on the unpardonable sin. Can we commit it today? And then Saturday night, dangers facing the church. Church has always plagued the problem. I want to say at the very beginning that this is the most complex and complicated issue. You might not agree with what I have to say, but I want you to give it serious consideration. We're friends, and we'll be friends after this is all over, but this is something, my friends, today that I believe that needs to be considered and studied as Christians in view of what we can find revealed in the Bible. To me, this is a biblical issue. It's a theological matter. It's a moral issue. If it were just a social matter, or if it were medical, or if it were economical, then I wouldn't be dealing with it tonight. I'd let somebody else handle it. But to me, it's a moral and ethical matter. And I think demands our attention as those who are following the lowly Nazarene. Now, I've observed, and I think you'll concur with me, that all of those who favor abortion have already been born. Just think about that. At the present time, it is estimated that there are between 30 to 35 million abortions in the world each year. In the United States, there are approximately 1 million abortions each year. And this has increased since the Supreme Court ruling on January 22nd, 1973, by a vote of 7-2, where they ruled that this was a matter entirely between the woman and her physician, that no state had the right to prohibit abortion for the first 3 months of pregnancy. And in the second 3 months, the state would only have the right to enact laws that would regulate abortion solely in consideration of the mother without any right of the fetus whatsoever. Only in the last 3 months, or when the fetus could become or is viable, may the state prohibit abortion. I think it was Judge Blackmun who ruled, saying we need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins. When those trained in the respective disciplines of medicine, philosophy, and theology are unable to arrive at any consensus, the judiciary, at this point in the development of man's knowledge, is not in position to speculate as to the answer. But it appears to me that they did speculate by ruling that the first 3 months it was simply a matter between the mother and her physician. Which really says that, as far as we're concerned, there is not a human being there for the first 3 months, yea, even the first 6 months. My position tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is that the embryo, the fetus, is a human being. And to my satisfaction, anyway, I have solved or resolved the issue, and I want you to consider some of the reasons that brought me to this conclusion. Abortion and for that matter, in infant killing, murdering of babies, has been going on in this world for thousands of years. We can trace abortion back to the ancient Chinese, 4,600 years ago, and read where an abortion was induced by mercury. We found some of the Egyptian papyrus wherein they state abortion is taking place. Aristotle and Plato advocated abortion on social and economical grounds. Hippocrates, the father of medicine, who was opposed to abortion, yet made the statement about an abortion that he induced in one of his patients. Aristotle said that the soul comes in a male fetus at 40 days and a female fetus at 80 days. How he determined that, I don't know. But interesting enough, the Catholic Church for years took that position that Aristotle advocated. Pope Sixtus V in 1588 eradicated the 40-day and 80-day rule, but Gregory the 14th returned to the 40 and 80-day rule. However, in 1869, Pius the 9th returned to the sanction of Sixtus the 5th. And the Catholic position today is that life, the soul, enters the cell or embryo at conception. And for all practical purposes, with maybe some few qualifications, this is my conclusion. Now, immediately the question arises in the minds of a lot of people, when does this unborn child or fetus or what have you become a human being? And really, as far as the Bible is concerned, I can't point my finger to a verse of Scripture and prove beyond a shade of a shadow of doubt at the exact moment the soul enters into the unborn child. Or if it doesn't, it hardly doesn't enter when the child is born. I think I can point out some statements, some guidelines, some principles, some scriptures in the Bible that show that this, what we call the fetus, or for that matter, an embryo, called the first 3 months after conception, is a human being. Now, the convenient idea for those who want an abortion is simply perceive that the fetus is not a person. You see, we don't call this a baby, but a fetus, it becomes an impersonal thing. The moment we speak of it as a baby, then it takes on a human being. So by and large, people don't look at this as a human being or a baby, but rather just a fetus or an embryo. Nothing more there than a glob of mass. Alive, yes, but no more alive than your finger or your kidney or your heart or your lung. And nobody's opposed, if it needs be, cutting off a finger, taking out a lung, or removing the kidney. Because neither one of those is human. That is, neither one has a soul. So if we look at the fetus the same way that we look at a kidney, then why should there be any objection of abortion? But I want to point out some things to you. The heartbeat of the unborn fetus begins between the 18th to 25th day, according to James M. Tanner in Article Growth in Life Science Library, Time Life Book, page 64. The electrocardiogram recording can be taken at 9 or 10 weeks in that same article. Electric brain waves have been recorded as early as 43 days. J.W. Steele, J. Washington Academy of Science, Body 59, page 46. Actual skeletal movements of the unborn baby begin at 6 weeks. The mother cannot feel them, however, at that time. Hooker, Davenport, The Prenatal Origin of Behavior, University of Kansas Press, 1952. Furthermore, at 9 to 10 weeks, he squints, swallows, moves his tongue, and if you stroke his palm, will make a tight fist. At 11 to 12 weeks, he is sucking his thumb vigorously. According to Hellinger's Medical Doctor, Fetal Development, Theological Studies, 1970, page 26. Here is what is killed. A fetus that squints, swallows, moves his tongue. He will tighten his fist. He's sucking his thumb vigorously. This life is taken. And if you see the picture of one of these, looks exactly like a baby that's already born, except size, in all practical purposes. By 11 to 12 weeks, he is breathing fluid steadily and continues so until birth. At birth, he will breathe air. He does not drown by breathing fluid within his mother because he obtains his oxygen from the umbilical cord. This does, however, develop the organs of respiration, and his stomach secretes gastric juices by 8 weeks. Fingernails are present by 11 to 12 weeks. Eyelashes by 16 weeks. All his body systems are present by 8 weeks, now get this, and are all working by 11 weeks. If you can abort, according to the ruling of the Supreme Court. Electrical waves at 6 weeks indicate brain function by that time. This is from Life Before Birth, Life Magazine reprint, page 13. Now, my feeling is, as I read this data, that you have here a human being. And I am the persuasion, brethren, that in this human being, there is a soul. And I think I can show that presently as we get into some biblical statements and principles. For our own benefit tonight, as we look at it from a broad perspective, I think what we need to consider the method of abortion. To me, it's a very repugnant, repulsive thing, and is a point to be considered because I think it has bearing on the whole abortion mill. There are four methods that are used to abort. One is called the DNC, up to 12 weeks. Yet it's very difficult, 10 to 12 weeks, where the obstetrician will take a knife that's cut and literally cut out the fetus, part by part. A forceps is used to crush the skull. And then this baby is cut to pieces, to bits, to parts, and a nurse stands by and gets the parts and puts them back together, reassembles them, so the physician is sure that he's got everything. Another method is the suction method, where a tube is put to a powerful pump and the baby is sucked out into the pump or container. And I have here, which I don't care to show you tonight, but I have here pictures of the entire operation, which to me are very, very crucial, where a baby is dismembered through this process of abortion. Now the third way is hysterotomy, a cesarean or mini cesarean operation where the baby is removed from the womb. Now these babies are taken and they are alive and permitted to die or even killed by the operating physician. Dr. R.F. R. Gardner, and I would recommend this book to you if you want to go into it in more detail. Dr. Gardner is an obstetrician. He's also a preacher in the Church of England. His position is that there's no soul in the fetus until birth. That's where I disagree with him. But it's an excellent book, and if you'd like to get it and go into it in more depth, then I would recommend it to you. But Dr. Gardner says on page 216, in connection with the hysterotomy, however, the removal of a perfectly formed, heart beating, chest moving, limb waving fetus is a most repugnant and quite literally nauseating procedure, both for the surgeon and for the theater nurse. This is one reason for most of us having an upper limit of duration of pregnancy where we say no to all but the most desperate cases. Well, why say no? Because the appearance of it, you see. Here's a fetus that's 12 weeks old, looks like a baby. One that may be a couple months old, no. But it's interesting to note in Time magazine, September 7, 1970, quote, it is difficult to get nurses to aid in abortions beyond the 12th week because nurses and often the doctors emotionally assume that a large fetus is more human than a small one. Now, if we're going to take the position that there's not any human being there or not any soul there until after birth, what difference does it make? What difference does it make? Here's a fetus that looks like a baby. Looks like a human being. And it's difficult to get a nurse and even some doctors to perform an abortion at this stage of development. One more method, and then we'll pass on. And that is the saline method, where concentrated salt is injected into the amniotic sac, amniotic fluid. And this baby ingests this. It's really poison. It takes about an hour for it to die, or a little longer. The skin is burned because of this concentrated salt. This baby suffers for over an hour. And then about a day later, sometimes a little longer, the mother goes into labor and gives birth to a dead baby. Here are the methods that are used. Now somebody says, preacher, is there ever a time that abortion is permissible? Well, it depends on which position you take. If it's not a human being, it's permissible to perform at any time. If there's nothing there but a glob of mass. But if it's a human being, then what do we do? The moral issue enters the picture. We've got to consider what God said. I'm saying it's a theological matter. What about a mother that's going to die unless she has an abortion? That rarely happens, but let's say it does happen. Then you got a choice to make, haven't you? The same kind of choice that if your wife and son or daughter were drowning and you only save one of them, which one are you going to save? You got that kind of a choice. The mother is going to die. And if she dies, the fetus will die. What are we going to do? The only way to save her is to abort. So we have to make that decision. I don't consider that murder. It's a matter of decision of saving the mother because the fetus is going to die anyway. What I'm talking about tonight is this abortion mill that we have in the world, accommodating adultery. Those who want to go out here and commit fornication, go down here to the hospital and get an abortion to cover the sin, take care of unwanted babies that are brought into the world. That's what I'm after tonight, friends. And I believe I can show by the Bible that it's immoral for one take the life of a fetus or a baby simply because it's unwanted, or to cover up sin, or some of the other things that are given as reasons for abortion. Now let's turn to our Bibles and do a little bit of study. Let's go back to the Old Testament. And we see where the emphasis is on the sanctity of life. Children were always considered a blessing, never a nuisance or an epidemic. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, and begin with verse, or Deuteronomy chapter 7, I'm sorry, begin with verse 12. Wherefore it shall come to pass, if you hearken to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord thy God shall keep unto thee the covenant and the mercy which he sware unto thy father. And he will love thee and bless thee and multiply thee. He will also bless the fruit of thy womb. See, having the child in was a blessing. It wasn't a burden. It wasn't a nuisance. It was a blessing. And God says, the fruit of thy land, thy corn, and thy wine, and thy oil, the increase of thy kind, the flocks, the sheep, and the land which he sware unto thy father, to give thee. Thou shalt be blessed above all people. Thou shalt not be male or female barren among you or among your cattle. So a child was a blessing. Then here in Psalms 127, verse 3, the psalmist says, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. Why, a child isn't a burden. A child is a blessing. Called here, heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. In Psalm 128, verse 3, thy children like olive plants round about thy table. Here were the olive trees they depended upon for their livelihood. The psalmist said, your children are just like your olive plants. Not something to be resented or something to be detested, but something that is a blessing unto you, just like your crop that you have for your livelihood. In Job 31, verse 15, did not he that made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb? Here the passage seems to suggest that it's God that makes the child in the womb. I know he does this by law, but it was God who inaugurated the law of procreation. So the child that's formed in the womb is spoken here as being put there by God, made thee in the womb. In Isaiah 44, verse 24, thus saith the Lord thy Redeemer, and he that formed thee from the womb, I am the Lord that maketh all things. So your children are blessed. And God formed them in the womb. Sterility in the Old Testament was a time for sorrow. Here are the wives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who were barren. But God blessed them, so that it's permitted to bring children into the world, and of course they thank God for it. We read further, in Genesis chapter 9, the shedding of innocent blood was prohibited. If a man shed blood, or shed the blood of a man, by man shall his blood be shed, for he's made in the image of God. Now, if here is a human being, my friend, which I believe it is, and we take that life and kill it, it's murder. I believe it's innocent blood. And God condemned it, and it runs all through the Old and New Testament. There's another passage I want to give you for your consideration. That's in Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verse 5. Now this is in the New English Bible, which says, you do not know how a pregnant woman comes to have a body and a living spirit in her womb. In the New American Standard Version, a footnote in that version says, that many manuscripts have in reference to Ecclesiastes 11, verse 5, how the spirit enters the bone. He said, now you don't know this, how the spirit enters the bone in the womb of the pregnant woman. Now in the New American Standard Version, there it has the pass of the wind. You don't know. But many of the manuscripts, according to the footnote, as you don't know how the spirit enters the bone in the womb of the pregnant woman. Suggesting then that the spirit enters while the child is still in the womb. Now, that's what I believe about it. That might be questionable, that particular text. But as we look at the guidelines and the overall picture, here we see the respectful life in the Old Testament. And the fact that God makes the fetus or the child in the womb. Now, that being the attitude in Old Testament times, we can immediately see why there weren't any abortions. Or for that matter, any specific teaching in the Old Testament against abortion. I believe, brethren, if we got a respect for life, considering a child as a heritage of God and as a blessing of God, something that's to be wanted rather than something that's considered as a burden or to be detested, I don't believe you'll find anybody over here at the abortion clinic. Except the mother that has to go to save their own life. That's the only ones that you find over there. You won't find a million slaughtered each year in this country, and 30 to 35 million in the world if they had respect and esteem for the dignity of life and the fact that God creates that life. That's fact. By his law, yes. A procreation, but God created, and yea, God puts it there. Now, how about the New Testament? The New Testament condemns murder just like the old. This principle in Genesis 9:6 never been changed. A man who commits murder is to be put to death. I believe Romans 13:4 teaches that. Paul said in Acts 25, verse 11, if I've done anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. Jesus, before Pilate in John 19:10-11, recognized his power to release him or to put him to death. But he said, you don't have this power unless God gave it to you. You remember Jesus told Peter in the 26th chapter of Matthew that they take the sword till out of the sword perish by the sword. That's a restatement of the principle in Genesis 9, verse 6. That if you shed the blood of a man, by man shall your blood be shed. That just stated another way of what's back yonder in Genesis 9, 6. So, the New Testament teaches that we can't take life without punishment. At least we ought to be punished. Not doing a very good job of it today. We got a lot of these do-gooders and bleeding hearts who have more consideration for the criminal and for the murderer than they do for the victim. I don't see anybody crying crocodile tears for these poor innocent victims. But here's a man in Utah the other day who said, I want to die rather than stay in prison. And here was the American Liberty Union, Civil Liberty Union, came to his rescue, said, we're going to the Supreme Court to see if we can get that stayed. We don't want him executed. The man wanted to die and may already be dead. I don't know. It took an overdose along with his girlfriend. Both of them may be dead by now. Friend, we don't get back to what God says, the matter of shedding innocent blood, and a man who does it, his blood has to be shed while we're going down the drain. Read the Numbers 35. See if that's not the case. We won't win that tonight. But God set forth some principles in that chapter. And I believe that when a man is a murderer and he's guilty, that he needs to be punished for. Alright, now let's look at some other things. In Matthew 7, verse 12, we got what we call the golden rule. Do unto others, in essence, as you would have them to do unto you. Would you want your mother to have snuffed out your life when you were about 3 to 6 months old? Aren't you glad she had enough respect for life that she permitted you to be born? I certainly am myself, I'll tell you that. That's why I said in the very beginning that the only ones I know who are for abortion are those who have already been born. If we'd been treated like a lot of people want to treat the unborn today, we'd never arrived in this world. And I believe the principle of what we call the golden rule enters the picture. But you consider James 2 and verse 26. James says that the body apart from the spirit is dead. Now, do we have a life or don't we in the womb? What is it that gives life to human beings? I'm not talking about the animal life now, like a dog or a cat. I'm saying what gives a life to a human being. I want to know what makes a human different from an animal. And the difference is that a human has an eternal, immortal spirit that his being lives on where the dog does. Now, we have an idea of the spirit that that's something just sort of separate and apart from us that floats around in here somewhere. Friend, you are the spirit. Your very being is the spirit. That's what the spirit is. It's you. It isn't something that's in you, separate and apart from you. Yet it is you. And that's what gives life to your body. Because the body apart from the spirit is dead. And hence we got life here, meaning then you have a connection of the spirit and the body, and the, hence life. But now there's a few more we want to look at in the New Testament. I'm asking you to turn to Luke chapter 1 and verse 41 begins. As far as I'm concerned, this is the question. Here the record says it came to pass that when Elizabeth heard the salutation of Mary, the babe leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Ghost. I want you to think with me here for just a little bit. The Bible says that the babe leaped in her womb. Now that's from the Greek word breakfast, B-R-E-P-H-O-S. And in Luke chapter 2, when the angels appeared unto the shepherds, they told them where Jesus could be found, and they said, now you go, and you'll find the babe, same word, breakfast, wrapped in swaddling cloth, lying in the manger. So here we have the word again, and it's used for the unborn, and it's used for the born. And the Bible doesn't make any distinction here. The same word for both of them. The Bible says that the unborn John the Baptist was a baby. But we come up today, we said, no, no, not John, no, it's a baby. That makes it impersonal, doesn't it? Now, I have no objection to calling it a fetus or embryo, medical standpoint, but the Bible says it's a baby. The same word that's used for Jesus after he was already born. He was a baby. And before he was born, he was a baby. Verse 44, lo, as soon as the voice of thy salutation sounded to mine ears, the babe leaped in my womb for joy. Now, if Elizabeth had an abortion, I don't know who she'd kill. You tell me? Would she kill an impersonal blob of mass? Was that what she killed? Or would she kill John the Baptist? I don't know which one she killed. Let's look at Jesus. Jesus was incarnated. I want to know for that period of 9 months where Jesus was if he weren't in the body of that infant. Where was Jesus for 9 months? When did Jesus' spirit come in? I'm saying that we might not be able to know exactly the moment it came in, but I believe, my friend, prior to the birth of our Lord, that his spirit was in that body. Look at what Elizabeth said. He said in verse 43, and whence is this to me that the mother of my Lord should come to me? I believe he recognized the Lord was in Mary. And as we look at the overall picture, I'm of the persuasion that an unborn child is a human being with a soul. I can't arrive at any other conclusion. But Well, somebody said, now, preacher, you pin it down as to the exact time that the Spirit comes into this unborn baby. I can't do that. I can't do that. I go back yonder to about conception. I know there's a matter of twinning. Dr. Gardner here deals with that. You take the identical twins, it's from 4 to 6 to 8 days or longer before they're cell division. You only have one cell. And he makes the point, are the two souls in one cell? And he says when it hooks up, attaches itself to the uterine wall, it still may not have divided yet into two different cells. And hence, when does the Spirit enter? I don't know for sure, but I would imagine when it becomes an embryo. That's my opinion. But I tell you right now, if I'm never able to pin it down, that's not my problem. It's the one who believes in it that has to pin it down. And I'll tell you why. Since nobody can know when. You see, the Bible just doesn't say when it happens. When nobody can decide when, and there's not a way in the world, friend, we can decide who's what's in this book, because that's what it's all about anyway when we start dealing with the soul of man. But you can't go out here and look through a microscope or through x-ray and find the soul of man as to when it enters and when it leaves. I heard about the test that was run, the experiment was run, they were going to set up an x-ray at the deathbed to see if they could see the soul leave. They didn't see anything. That wasn't from that standpoint. They were going to weigh a man to see if he weighed less after he died than before he died. Then they conclude something left him. That's like the professor in college that ran the experiment on a grasshopper. He got the grasshopper and he said, now I got to find out where his ears are. You know, he clapped his hand, he jumped. So he pulled off a leg, he clapped his hand, he jumped. He said, well, it's not in that leg. He pulled off another leg and he jumped and hit his hand. He jumped a little bit, you know, and he said, well, it's not in those two legs, that's for sure. He pulled them all off down to one and he clapped. He said, well, must be in that one, and he pulled that off, and he got, and he couldn't move. He said, that's right, that's what it's in. It's in that last leg for sure. Well, that's the way we are sometimes in our spirit. I don't know when the Spirit enters, but that's not my problem. Because the man who's going to perform the abortion, the woman who's going to submit herself to it and agree to it, he's the one that's put in the position to have to know when is it murder. And I can sympathize with a lot of people who are involved in this because they got a responsibility. You take the preaching out here has a moral responsibility, and some are greatly concerned about it as to what they should do, and I appreciate their thinking. They're the ones who have to make the decision. Here's a mother who may die unless she has an abortion. I can appreciate that, and I can sympathize with her, and maybe we can write some kind of agreement that will be satisfactory and yet in keeping with moral principles. But if we don't know when the Spirit enters, then we always have the risk of murdering a human being. Now you just mark that down. There's no way to get around that, my friend. That's what needs to be honest from the housetop. There's no way in the world that we can decide when it happens, but one who performed it and without any legitimate reason is the one who's saying, well, I hope it's not murder. It might be, but I just hope it's not. Now, in the magazine America, in the American magazine, the Catholic magazine, but James J. Diamond wrote an article in 1969. He pointed out that in the event of a cave in, or when a submarine goes down, or a plane is lost at sea, or a building catches fire, our instinctive reaction is to work on the assumption that somewhere in that mine, beneath that sea, or beyond those flames, is a human life to be saved. I want you to listen. This is written. We don't demand proof that life is there. We act simply on the possibility. We do not quibble about what kind of existence we would be returning the miners to, its quality, its desirability, its wholesomeness. We just assume that there's life there, and we're going to get it out regardless of what kind of conditions it is. Now, let me tell you something, neighbor. This idea that here's a fetus that's going to be deformed for the rest of its life, and we don't want that kind of a child coming in the world, and we're going to kill it. Well, why don't we just let the minor die and the mind? If we find out he's deformed, why don't we put him to sleep? Do we want some paralytic who's paralyzed from his neck down as a vegetable for left for the rest of his life to live? Well, he couldn't enjoy that. That's killing. But no, no. If he has to live that way, we want to get him out. Regardless of the kind of life that he's going to have. I don't buy this notion that simply because you have a deformed fetus that we need to kill. Now, this drug thalidomide that was used to form children, Mrs. Finkbein back in the early 60s had to fly to Sweden to get an abortion. It was ready to form. But you know, we go on the assumption that if you're deformed, you can have a happy life. That isn't necessarily so. In a psychological meeting, course, the conclusion was reached, and I have a quotation here, but the conclusion was reached that we assume that deformed people, mentally retarded, whatever they are, that they can't live a happy life. They said that's an assumption. For all we know, they live a happy life. Well, now, preacher, why, we don't want to bring them in the world if they don't have anything to eat much and anything to wear. Friend, if I'd been in the case, I'd never come around. I'd never been here. Well, I was born back down in those post-depression days in the early 30s. And we didn't have anything where I grew up. You're talking about poor. We grew up in Eastern Kentucky. Luther Blackman said it was a far faster than any direction he went. Poor time. That's how far back it was. And we didn't have anything. We hardly had anything to eat or anything to wear. But I don't think my mother ever thought, well, if we can't enjoy our life and have, you know, all of the goodies, well, we're just going to take care of it. That's no reason. We don't operate on that basis when something happens of a catastrophic nature in minds or what have you. We search and we look. They just might be one down there. We don't think that anybody could survive, but we're going to work around the clock in case one does. But turn that around, turn the coin over. In the case of abortion, our response operates in a manner diametrically opposite. Here the action is based on an assumption, a hunch, a hope, or even a prayer that a human life does not exist in that use. What a contrast is. We don't know that it doesn't exist. We just hope it does. Because if it does, we're merciful. And friend, that's the problem. That's the risk. And I'm not going to take it. I believe it's a human being. I believe it has a soul in it. Someone wrote, did you come from a human baby? No, you were the baby. Did you come from a human fetus? No, you were the fetus. Did you come from a human embryo? No, you were the embryo. You stop to think everything you are today and everything I am today, we're exactly like we were back there in the embryonic stage. You think about that. It's just a matter of development and growth and nutrition. But everything that we are, we were in the embryonic phase. You haven't changed one bit. As far as you're at. Not one bit. So if you stand tonight, that here's an unborn child is a human being. And my conviction is with the soul and with the biblical guidelines that we have, I believe our position to be that we're opposed, adamantly opposed, in the abortions of unborn babies. He's unable to take care of himself, lives. His life is in his full, he can't be very satisfied. Why not just put him to sleep like we do a horse? Somebody said, well, that wouldn't happen for you. Don't you think one moment that can happen? It can happen, and it may happen, unless we do something about it. And you know, mom and dad, they're getting old, and we've got to fool with them and bother with them. And it'd be better, I think. I believe they'd be happier if they just passed on. So let's give them a shot. Put them out.
out of misery. It's for our own good. We're compassionate. That's true. I think that perhaps could be the next step in this country. And friend, we don't want that. I believe life is something to be respected. Life is something that has dignity. And we can't survive as a citizenry or a society or a culture if we treat human life just like we do now.